Our 44th president can be used as a lens through which we can see not only politics, but also art and music. This hour, Barack Obama has represented in popular culture. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we'll hear from two University of Iowa graduate students who've written a book called The Iconic Obama. It's a book of essays reflecting on media representations of the president. Also, Donna Hoffman is with us of the University of Northern Iowa. She'll give us the latest political analysis of the Connecticut school tragedy and fiscal cliff negotiations. Politics Wednesday gets started right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday here on the program, and joining us today, Donna Hoffman, the chair of political science, this political science department at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Nice to have you back on after a few weeks' absence, Donna.
It's good to be here once again.
And we want to talk about a few things in this first half hour. Of course, the tragedy in Sandy Hook, and we'd like to get our listeners' feedback to this, some of the headlines that we've been consuming here, Donna, all of us, about the elementary school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut last Friday. 20 children, 6 adults killed by that gunman who attacked the Sandy Hook Elementary School. President Obama launching an administration-wide effort to curb gun violence. He asking Vice President Joe Biden, a longtime gun control advocate, to spearhead the effort. The National Rifle Association now saying it is prepared, in its words, to offer meaningful contributions to help make sure this never happens again, planning to hold a news conference on Friday. The funerals continue, memorials today to 6-year-old girls, 7-year-old boy, and the teacher Victoria Soto, a 27-year-old, being memorialized today and laid to rest. I want to start off by asking you very broadly if you could capture for us, Donna Hoffman, how you see the Sandy Hook tragedy changing politics in Washington and across the country.
Well, you know, we've seen a number of shootings in the past few years, Virginia Tech, Gabby Giffords, the Aurora shooting. And after those events, in particular, you got some discussion about something should be done, but not a lot of effort in terms of trying to advance any legislation. And very quickly, I think, after those events occurred, the discussion dropped off. And what is I think, different about the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting is that it involves 6- and 7-year-olds. And that is a little bit different proposition in this particular tragedy. And so this may be an event that actually prompts a discussion at multiple levels, and one that would extend in time, but also include something in Congress in terms of legislation being moved. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that legislation would be enacted, but obviously a precursor to that is to have a discussion about it. And I think that this event is qualitatively different enough from some of the other ones that we've seen. Plus, there's also an accumulation effect here, I think, as well, mm-hmm. that will prompt a conversation about it. And likely, I mean, we already know Senator Feinstein has already said she will reintroduce in the next Congress the assault weapons ban legislation. So we know that there will be some things to talk about in Congress. Whether those things can actually move through the legislative process is a little bit different proposition. And that's, you know, where you can potentially have a president make a difference if President Obama wants to get involved in terms of keeping this at the forefront and keeping the issue before the public and before Congress, then you might actually see some meaningful movement on this issue.
We want to hear from our listeners this hour, this half hour in particular. Donna Hoffman, you mentioned discussions, this starting discussions. We want to hear from you, River to River listeners, what discussions it started with you. What are your thoughts as these victims of the Sandy Hook school shooting are memorialized and laid to rest over the past coming days? After so many mass shootings in recent years, is this a turning point, or will it fade like the other mass shootings that we've encountered? What would you say, River to River listeners, to our political leaders about what needs to be changed. Our gun laws, our mental health policies, our attitudes towards violence in society. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. I'm wondering, Donna, the basis of you saying that this could be something quite different than the reactions we've seen to the other shootings in recent years. I'm remembering West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, a loyal NRA member, now, I think, believed coming out yesterday saying he's willing to consider new gun laws along with other measures. How significant is that?
I think it's pretty significant. He didn't have to come out and say that. He came out and said it, you know, relatively recently or shortly after the shooting. And that was something that, you know, I don't think a lot of people expected. And it was significant in the fact that he does have a, you know, good rating from the NRA. He's from West Virginia. He's a conservative Democrat. Another significant feature about him is he just was reelected and so doesn't have to stand for election anytime soon. And so he can be a person who, well, there's certainly normal characters in Congress you would expect to come out and say things about this event. He was not one of those characters. And so the fact that he was pretty prominent initially in this debate caused some people, I think, to consider what would the NRA's position be on this. And we don't know that yet. Of course, you mentioned that they're going to have a news conference on Friday. And to see if they're going to remain, you know, fairly absolutist in their stance on legislation, or if there is some significant movement that can be done that would include, you know, people in Congress like Joe Manchin.
Mm-hmm. President Obama traveling to Newtown, Connecticut over the weekend to offer, in his words, the love and prayers of a nation to those families grieving the loss of loved ones after this school shooting. Consoling, but also offering a call to action, promising to use the power of his office to put an end to such tragedies.
This is our first task, caring for our children. If we don't get that right, we don't get anything right. Can we truly say, as a nation, that we're meeting our obligations? The answer is no. These tragedies must end. And to end them, we must change.
A short clip from President Obama in Newtown, Connecticut. I don't know, Donna, if you had the chance to see the entire video and audio, listen to the audio of that, wails from audience, people there listening to President Obama. Very moving experience. No offer of a concrete plan for change. What can we talk about as politically feasible? Has been thrown out there, renew on the ban on assault weapons, the limiting the size of weapon clips. Often these weapon clips are very large that have been used in these mass killings. Or make everyone who buys a weapon subject to background checks and not have this loophole through the gun shows.
Right. And I think those are all things that we'll see some action or at least some discussion on. You know, certainly the assault weapons ban and the magazine clip issue, both were aspects of the 10-year ban that we had from 94 to 2004. It expired then. And those are certainly things that Congress has done before, obviously. And so there's a starting point in those areas. The gun show loophole has often been talked about as something that ought to be closed, and I think that will be part of that issue that comes along with this. You also could have some mental health issues in terms of how people with mental health issues are dealt with in the healthcare system. That certainly goes, you know, a pace with the healthcare reform legislation that is going to be implemented in the coming years, and we may see some movement on that particular issue as well as a related issue that Congress could do some action on.
1-866-780-9100. Donna Hoffman, our guest on this edition of Politics Wednesday, in the aftermath of the Sandy Hook tragedy, the shootings, talking about this for a good part of this hour, and joining us from Mount Vernon, Slayton. Hi, Slayton.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you, sir?
Fine. I'm a city councilor in Mount Vernon, Iowa, and the Sandy Hook shooting has brought to me that I don't have faith any longer in our state or national figures to make these decisions. So I believe it's our job as local local elected officials now to begin pushing everything we can do to make our community safe from this type of violence.
Slayton Kitt, since you are on the council there, can you tell us your full name, please?
Slayton Anthony.
Slayton Anthony. What have you talked with other council members about doing something on a local basis?
Yeah, I've mentioned it at our last council meeting, and then I've specifically spoken to one other council member. It's a five-person council, so getting close to something. And I'm also on our safety committee that meets with our police chief. And so one of the things I came to realize over the weekend and had to face the reality was, is if I do not take action on our local level to do anything I can to protect our children, then I am as bad as the federal officials who refuse to act.
We've had so many mass shootings, so many tragedies in the past year. Slayton, what made this different for you? What moment got to you?
It's very personal to me in that I have a child who has four distinct emotional disorders, and I have a daughter who is 5 years old, and Mount Vernon is, I would consider to be, well, we're ranked one of the top coolest cities small towns in the U.S., so it struck home that nowhere is safe, specifically nowhere is safe from gun violence and nowhere is safe from mental health issues. I don't allow weapons in my home, but I was raised on a farm with weapons, and I had weapons or rifles in my bedroom growing up, and accidentally blew a hole in the wall once as a 12-year-old kid. But So I don't fear, nor do I demonize weapons. I realize what they are. I've also retired 22 years in the military. So the fascination, I have no fascination with weapons, but I do recognize the harm they can pull in instant. And that's what we have to protect our children against.
Slayton Anthony, thank you very much. We have a number of other people who want to get on the conversation. We do appreciate you getting in touch with us, though.
Thank you.
Slayton Anthony calling as a city council member in Mount Vernon. Join our conversation. Your thoughts as the victims of the Sandy Hook school shooting are memorialized and laid to rest, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Excuse me. Bobby in Cedar Falls. Hi, Bobby.
Hi.
Go ahead, please. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Well, I had a couple of comments, and the first thing I was going to say is that I think it really is a matter of, you know, how families are formed nowadays. I think a lot of people come from bad homes, and I think that's, I think these issues could be resolved if there were, you know, appropriate measures taken earlier on in somebody's life.
Mm-hmm. With mental health, what do you see in terms of what local, municipal, state, or national government could do differently in regards to mental health policy?
That's actually what my other comment was, is I've been diagnosed with mental health issues, you know, ranging from depression to OCPD and ADHD, but I can say confidently, you know, someone could shoot up my whole family, and I would never retaliate by taking another life. So I wonder how far, you know, and I wonder if people are going to start lumping all the mental health issues into one bucket and saying, you know, no one with any diagnosis can have a weapon.
Okay, Bobby from Cedar Falls, thank you for that comment. Donna Hoffman, what are you hearing in these comments, these last two comments here that you find interesting?
You know, I think there's just a level of frustration. I mean, we heard it with the city council member in terms of, you know, if politicians at higher levels aren't going to do things, then I'm going to act. I think you also have, this was in a public school, and there's public schools everywhere. And you know, especially elementary schools are really taking a very hard look at their policies, at the drills that they do, how to be prepared. And, you know, that is something that is good that it is taking place. It's a tragedy, of course, serious further contemplation of these kinds of issues are prompted, you know, by a tragedy of this scope. So I think a wake-up call might be an apt phrase, you know, to use here, in that it appears that it might be waking up policymakers,
right,
and certainly community members across the United States. I mean, everybody has a public school.
Right.
Everybody has a public elementary school not very far from their house, because that's how we do public education in this country.
But at the same time, when we talk about security at public schools, elementary schools, what have you, and we take it to the logical extreme, we end up with something that resembles a prison, don't we?
Well, I mean, it has to be very carefully weighed, because you have, you know, children need to be safe. They need to be in a safe learning environment in order to learn. But they also, you know, don't probably need to see armed police officers walking around the hallways of their schools. Now, in some inner city schools, that is already a reality for a lot of children. But there is certainly a proper balance that has to be here. And that is something that, you know, public school administrators very carefully have to weigh, and there's also a resource question here as well,
mm-hmm.
In that they may not have the resources that they would want to expand things to the level that they would want to do in terms of security. But this is, you know, certainly something that's being reevaluated and reassessed all across the country because of the nature of where this shooting took place.
Donna Hoffman with us, the Political Science Department at the University of Northern Iowa. Politics Wednesday, after the mass shootings, the most recent mass shooting in Connecticut. So, River to River listeners, what would you say to our political leaders needs to change? What would you say about our gun laws, perhaps, or mental health policy, attitudes towards violence in society in general? We're asking for your input. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us, if you like, at IPR Talk. Esom, in North Dakota, listening to Iowa Public Radio. Great to have you on our airwaves.
Hi. I had a kind of two comments about this. First thing is, there's a lot of people already have assault rifles, and minimizing it is not going to, you know, further prevent any future accident or incident. And the other thing is that Second Amendment did not say that, okay, you can have shotgun or you cannot have assault rifle, and you can have that many in your magazine. So that can, in a Supreme Court, become unconstitutionalized. Or, you know, it may pass. It just depends. But I think it's more, it would be more suitable to find out people who have disabilities or people who have some sort of, I don't know, mental disturbance, to keep preventing them having guns, even if it's inherited to them. Or, you know, this situation, unfortunate situation, came in, was a legal purchase. I don't think there was anything stolen.
Right.
So I think to prevent those things, it would be okay if the person does not have a possession of it, or somebody else, giving more education to safeguard the weapons. Because, I mean, gun, as we know, is not going to walk and kill somebody else.
Right.
It is poor judgment of people, or I guess crime of passion, or something within that kind of domain.
Esom, thank you very much. You've also put in other words, no easy solutions here. What kind of policies can get at this and really solve it? Esom in North Dakota commenting how difficult it really is. Gene in Iowa City, what's on your mind? Hello, Gene, you're on
yes,
the air.
Hi,
welcome to our program.
I just wanted to suggest that we need to sort of change our attitude towards the carrying of weapons here in Iowa. Since we changed to a shall issue state just in Johnson County, it's really mind-boggling how many people are now carrying weapons in the county. And what
how do you know? Excuse me, Gene. Let me jump in, because if they're concealed weapons, I don't know that they have them. How do you know that so many people
are? I'm basing it on the listing that is posted by the county on the permits that have been applied for, and the numbers have increased by 100-fold.
Okay, very good. Go on with your comment. Thank you.
And so what we're trying to do is to frequent businesses that post no weapons, and that would include even permanent carriers, to sort of show that we really don't want to be eating dinner or going to movies or shopping where people, even if they're permitted, are walking around with weapons. And like Dahl's Grocery Store in Des Moines does that. The Fairway does not. John's Grocery Store here in Iowa City, the New Pioneer Co-op, Red's restaurant, all of Mondo's restaurants. And so we're trying to do that, and I just would like to suggest that other folks also start frequenting businesses that do it. The new Costco bans weapons, too.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Gene. from Iowa City. Donna, do you want to get in here before we go to another caller?
Sure. I mean, I think there's, you know, both of these two callers are looking at, you know, doing something. What can be done? You know, here's a grassroots effort. Boycott the local establishments in Iowa who allow concealed weapons in. Frequent the ones that don't. And this, you know, frustration with, you know, an assault weapons ban is, you know, quite frankly, limited because you, you know, when we had done that before, it affects the manufacturer, the sale of those things. But you still have those things, as the caller from North Dakota pointed out, you still have those out there amongst people, and they still exist. And, you know, for a ban to be effective, you know, a lot of time has to pass. That ban that was in place was only in place for 10 years, and the manufacturer began again and sale. And so I think, you know, what policymakers are going to want to be looking at is multi-prong attempts at how to get at this problem, because it is a problem that has multiple factors. We've talked about the mental health issue, the supply, the regulation, and certainly no ban in terms of guns, period, is ever going to pass constitutional muster because we have the Second Amendment. But there are things that can be done, and the question is how far to take those, what's the balance, what can get passed, quite frankly. And so this is a very, very complex issue that has lots of causes to, you know, when we get these mass shootings.
Let's go quickly to Madison, calling from Britt, Iowa. Madison, not much time. What's your comment or question?
I would just like to say that I think that I'm glad that there's discussion about all these different laws that we could put in place, like the conceal and carry and assault weapon ban, but I don't think that they're going to be the grand solution. What I think we need to really talk about here, and what I wish our leaders would say a little bit more, is that it's not powerful government oversight that's going to stop and regulate these kind of problems. It starts with the people. All kinds of evil is overdone by small good things that average Americans can do for each other in an average, ordinary setting. I think if our presidents and our congressmen would start talking about things in that sense, that we could grow past this. I mean, if this poor, tragic soul who did this horrible, terrible, terrible act would have had a shoulder to lean on a weak hand before, you know, maybe this entire thing could have been averted. We need to stop getting such into arms about what the next policy step is and get more concerned about mm-hmm. what we can do in an average setting to be more kind to the average American.
Madison, very quickly, we have just a few seconds before we have to take a break. What are you doing as an individual?
As an individual, I would just like to say that I'm doing my best now more than ever after seeing this kind of tragedy to just tell the people I do love that I love them and have more open arms for people in, you know, in an average public setting. Well, there might be a guy, you know, out and about who looks off on his own or is, you know, homeless in the street, something like that. Just a random, like, small acts of kindness can completely change a person's perspective on life.
Okay, thank you. A message of compassion from Madison, phoning in from Britt. Thank you very much, Britt, Madison.
Thank you very much, and I really enjoy your show.
Thank you so much for those kind words. When we come back after a short break, we'll continue Politics Wednesday here on River to River. We're going to shift our conversation to talk with two University of Iowa graduate students who've written a book called The Iconic Obama. It's a book of essays reflecting on media representations of the president's relationship to pop culture, if you will. That's what we're going to talk about with Nicholas Yannis when we come back, and also Darius Carter, two graduate students at the University of Iowa. Donna Hoffman, I hope you'll stay around with us, too, to comment as well.
I certainly will.
Chair of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday here. And in our first half hour, a lot of comments, analysis about the Sandy Hook school shootings, undoubtedly a discussion that we hear on public radio on this talk show will continue in the weeks, months to come and follow that. We want to shift gears, change our focus slightly on this Politics Wednesday. Donna Hoffman with us, Chair of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. We have some other guests to introduce as well. As we heard in our news, President Obama being named Time Magazine's Person of the Year fits really well into what we're going to talk about this half hour primarily. The 44th president can also be used as a lens through which we see politics, not only politics, but also art, comics, music. This hour, we're talking to two University of Iowa graduate students. They've edited a book that looks at Barack Obama as represented in popular culture. The book is called The Iconic Obama, 2007 to 2009, Essays on Media Representations of the Candidate and the New President. Joining me in the studio in Iowa City, Nicholas Yanis. He is an American Studies PhD candidate at the University of Iowa, also a Dean's Graduate Research Fellow at the UI. Also at the UI, joining us, Darius Carter, also an American Studies doctoral candidate, also at the UI, and also teaches rhetoric. Nicholas and Darius, welcome to our studio.
Thank you for having us.
Let me start with you, Nicholas Yanis, because I understand you had this idea. What is the idea, and what inspired you to put together this collection of essays about that you titled The Iconic Obama?
The main inspiration actually came from my niece. At the time of the election, she was five. And I just remember sort of visiting my family in Chicago. My niece was so excited about the election. My family's not very political. My stepdad's an NRA member. My mother's more liberal. But my niece knew the presidential candidates. She was adamant that I vote for Obama. I just sort of was stunned that this small person was so passionate about the election. And I realized at that moment that there was something unique about this election, that a five-year-old from a sort of politically uninterested family was aware of these candidates and still was encouraging me to sort of vote a certain way. Also, at the same time, I've always been a fan of sort of popular culture and media, and I just noticed Obama appearing in all my comic books in different sort of venues of him teaming up with Spider-Man. DC Comics has an alternate reality Superman in which instead of Superman being Clark Kent, he's actually President Obama. And I realized that there was something about this presidential figure where he was appearing in so many different forms of pop culture that it had to be analyzed, that there was something there that had to be sort of deconstructed to be better understood.
So you do analyze it in a series of essays in different categories. Mm-hmm. You put these essays. And Nicholas, you are in charge of, I think, more of the political wing of this book. Mm-hmm. And the aspects, list the aspects that you look at, that the essays examine, that you looked after.
The ones I specifically looked after were the section I'm dealing with comic books. I also, we both took a hand at looking at movies and film representation. Darius took a more look at the music section. I also had a hand in more of the news media representation section. I was able to fortunately interview both a journalist from France to talk about sort of French journalism and their sort of representation of Obama, as well as interview our resident dean, Dan Berkowitz, mm-hmm. About sort of news media representation and how the news media covered Obama as well.
Darius Carter, as co-editor of this book, I believe you focused on race and masculinity issues. You are an African-American yourself. How did being the first African-American president play into this campaign narrative and President Obama's popularity as you see it?
Mm-hmm. For me, in many respects, it made Americans, it made voters, it made fans, consumers, it made all of us consider the possibilities that come along with having a black president. Many of us had very romantic ideas about what this meant for our nation. We knew that, you know, it meant for that first campaign, hope and change. You know, we knew that was going to be a part of it, but we really didn't know what it looked like. And so one of the things that I really wanted to do with this connection, Nick and I wanted to do with this collection, was figure out what people were, how people were interpreting this moment. So it's like, what were they seeing in this moment? What were the possibilities they were imagining? And how was that being conveyed through various artistic mediums? So film, art, literature, and even for me personally, thinking about how the hip-hop community was responding to Obama. I think Travis Lars Goza has an amazing piece where he's talking about how rappers respond to the idea of a black president. Because I think many Americans would assume, or they would have assumed the first election, that, oh, he's black. Black people are going to vote for this brother in a heartbeat. But there's also a critical undercurrent that's occurring, you know, that occurred both in the first election, but also this more recent election, where people are really coming to grips with what it means to have a black candidate, what that suggests about our nation's progress in regards to race, but also the work that we still have to do.
There's an example that you mentioned that we want to play a little bit of, and I'd like to have you comment on, Darius, an ad that many of our listeners would have seen featuring iconic actor, Samuel L. Jackson, very famous Hollywood actor, of course. He released this ad. We're going to hear part of it in an effort to mobilize voters that seemed more apathetic about 2012 than they did about 2008. Let's listen to the beginning of this because it's quite remarkable in that we have Samuel L. Jackson, an African-American, in the homes of what? A white family doing
right.
What?
Yeah, it's a white family. He hits like three different generations. He's moving through the house, magically appearing, which that's a whole nother conversation, but magically appearing with a young white girl. He talks to parents. He talks to the teenage kids in the household, but he also talks to the grandparents. So he's hitting three generations of voters in order to try to get them to the polls.
Let's hear the first approximately a minute of this ad featuring Samuel L. Jackson from the 2012 election campaign.
In the silvery moonlight that bathes every town, the people lie dreaming, so safe and so sound. They're warm in their beds, snuggled up in their sheets. But 4 years before, they were out in the streets. Now it's as if they don't know what's at stake. All except one girl, wide-eyed and awake. Little Susie is too worried to sleep. She can't figure out why her family's so passive. It's like they don't know that Romney and his Veep will remake the country in ways that are drastic. She read his platform and it scared her to death. She's got to do something while there's still time left.
I was little the last time, but I still remember. My whole family was out working together. We canvassed and phone banked with passion and pluck. It matters more this time, but their eyes are shut.
Mom, Dad, the election's coming up soon.
We're tired right now, hon. Go back to your room.
Sorry, my friend, but there's no time to snore. An out-of-touch millionaire's just declared war. On schools, the environment, unions, fair pay. We're all on our own if Romney has his way. And he's against safety nets. If you fall, it's tough luck. So I strongly suggest that you wake the f*** up.
Samuel L. Jackson, a portion of an ad released as part of the 2012 election campaign. Donna Hoffman, you've been listening to this conversation about this book, The Iconic Obama, as he appears in popular culture. Your reaction to, for instance, that ad or the remarks that Darius and Nicholas have made here?
Well, you know, I think we saw in 2008 with Obama, you know, this iconic image, which is what the editors are writing about. And you know, that had effects on governing. It had effects on the 2012 election even. So people were very excited about Obama in 2008, and he comes into office, and he is able to do actually, you know, his legislative success rate in his first 2 years was very, very good. He gets some major legislation, health care reform among them. But people wanted more, I think, out of Obama because of the way the 2008 election had been framed, because he became this figure in popular culture. He excited people's imagination, and people were disappointed. And, you know, that's what Samuel L. Jackson is essentially getting at in that ad is that, you know, look, don't be complacent. You know, maybe Obama didn't do everything that you wanted him to do, but you know, and so it had an effect on governing and what Obama could and couldn't do. And of course, you know, he, in the second part of his first term, encountered, you know, lots of opposition in terms of congressional Republicans. Right. And so, you know, the way that we perceive presidents, even in comic books, oftentimes has an effect on governing.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, you talked about hope and change, Darius, there, too. You know, we had as a common theme in this 2012 election, a lot of people calling into this show, or we heard it in other news outlets, plenty of them, registering disappointment in President Obama, his promises, his hope and change. In fact, Michelle Bachmann, one of them, using Sarah Palin, rather, using the hopey changey thing, trying to turn it on its head, using it against President Obama. So how was hope and change reflected differently in the second campaign compared to the first? Nick, first you.
Well, I think one of the lessons that I hope the Obama administration learned from the first election, as well as I think other future political leaders are going to learn, is that President Obama made a comment that there's a time to govern and a time to campaign. And I think in this media environment we now have, that's the mistake, is that you now have to campaign for everything you want to pass for, and you have to campaign for the success of everything, of every legislative success you've had. So a good example is that while the majority of Americans have had their taxes drop, the vast majority of Americans still think that their taxes have gone up under Obama. And that was sort of, that's a communication flaw. He should have been campaigning for that success across every different media outlet he could get into. And I don't think that him or his cabinet and his supporters have actually been able to successfully communicate that message. What I think what happened back in the 2012, in the most recent election, while that dissatisfaction was there, I think many of his base were sort of shocked by the Republican candidates and many of the comments they've made. And I think they were sort of able to sort of motivate and organize better at the last moment.
Darius Carter.
Yes, but for me, it was also a moment for Americans to really step up and say, okay, it's not enough for us to say we want the president to do these things, or we want our elected officials to do these things, but we have a civic responsibility to move on the ground. Mm-hmm. You know, in the last segment, there was that final caller who talked about trying to figure out the day-to-day things that we can do to enact change in our country. And I think whether it's the tragedy that occurred recently or it's, you know, day-to-day politics, there's always something that we can do on the ground to stay conscious and alert about the type of change that we can create. And so I think if the first election left a lot of people kind of bitter, you know, and, you know, we were wondering what was going to happen with Obama this next term, then now's not simply the time for us to critique him, but it's also the time for us to step up and say, look, if this is what we want to happen, we've got to move on the ground as well.
Going back to something you said, Nick Yanis, earlier about the campaign, something to the effect that the campaign never ending. Donna Hoffman, are you observing that too? Disconcerting that we see, to some people certainly, that we see a different Obama going into the second term, and that he has a different strategy here. He is what, going to the grassroots?
I think he will a lot more because, you know, the organization that they put together in 2012 was phenomenal. And I think you are seeing a reflection back to 2008 that they didn't do enough to activate that coalition that they, you know, was pretty good in 2008, quite frankly, but they didn't use it in the interim years, and then they were able to reactivate it to pretty great success in 2012. And now I think there is this realization that they have to keep working on those people who were activated in 2012 and get them to write their member of Congress for this issue and get them to go and, you know, to a town hall meeting on another issue. Mm-hmm. And I think there is more of a realization than that is. In political science, we've known for a long time that, you know, the features of the permanent campaign, as we call it, and, you know, the problem then becomes is that campaigning, the skills that you need for that are not always the skills you need for governing, and that can cause us some problems. But certainly Obama, I think, and his administration now are going to at least try to use this database that they have that they used to great effect in the 2012 election and put it to some uses, trying to help them govern now.
Donna Hoffman with us, University of Northern Iowa, Chair of Political Science. We have also in our studio joining a conversation on this Politics Wednesday, Nick Yanis and Darius Carter. They are both American Studies doctoral candidates, co-editors of a book called The Iconic Obama, which looks at media representations of the candidate through essays in the book, and we're comparing how this candidate has changed. When we talk about President Obama, Obama in popular culture, we had a field day trying to find audio for this. In fact, we could have filled up many hours of radio. Here's one that many of our listeners will remember. Pop culture seems to have embraced this president for his cool factor, if I can say it that way. Here he is at the Apollo Theater. You will remember this, most likely.
And then to know that Reverend Al Green was here. I'm so in love with you. Those guys didn't think I would do it.
I wonder, when we talk about the popularity of President Obama in this context, if we can compare him to any past presidents. When we talk about other iconic presidents, we certainly have to mention JFK, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, in a more contemporary era on Arsenio Hall, perhaps playing his saxophone, Darius.
Yeah, absolutely. And thinking about that clip where Obama's singing, one, I absolutely loved it. It just makes me smile. But it's a pleasure to see a president that's as I guess, as, I don't know, outgoing, as personable as Obama is. And so I like to see a president that can joke, that can laugh, that has the courage to cry in front of the American public. But I also think it's worth considering how his coolness and how his swag, how his swagger, how all of that is such a central part of his public image. And so when I think Reagan, I think cowboy. When I think JFK, like, he's got this suave demeanor to him. When I think Clinton, you know, I just remember growing up in the 90s and thinking about that Arsenio Hall appearance and jokingly having, you know, my family say, you know, right, well, that's kind of like the first black president right there.
Right. I can hear, though, listeners through the walls from across Iowa saying, where is this conversation going on politics day? We're descending into a point where, what do we decide elections on the basis of issues, positions on issues, or this simply this feel-good factor delivered by pop culture? Mm-hmm. And that perhaps a criticism of you two could be, You've had a drink of the Kool-Aid. You're in a feel good fest for Obama. Let's straighten up and look at this a different way.
Well, and that is a fair criticism, that as politicians become more savvy in regards to the realms of popular culture, that it's going to be a popularity contest. It's going to be reduced to your high school elections of, do we want the football player or the cheerleader to become the class president? But I think what it is that they're using popular culture in a way to actually better communicate their political messages and to better communicate the ideology of their politics better. And I think that's one of the things that we hope to get out of this project, is that to sort of help give people the tools to better understand how these representations really embody these political messages and how to better deconstruct them.
Donna Hoffman, what do you have to say about that, about how we as voters decide our vote, the basis of a feel-good factor, pop culture versus the issues? What is your comment on that?
Well, I mean, I think you saw in the 2012 election between Obama and Romney, you know, Romney just was never able to come across to the American people as someone that they could identify with. He was very removed from, I think,
he
most
did try to sing, though.
Yes, he did. That is true. Not probably quite as well as President Obama, but that's another show. And so, you know, Obama was able to talk about his student loans, for example. And, you know, those are things that do have policy implications. So it's not necessarily just that people are voting based on popularity, but Obama was able to show voters a person who, you know, relatively recently had paid off his student loans, had, you know, gone through law school, had, you know, done things that Americans could identify with, a little bit less so, I think, with Romney. And sometimes, you know, there is some element of popularity there, likability, but there can be policy implications to those things as well.
Mm-hmm. Darius.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with Professor Hoffman. I think when I'm listening to music, like when I have my iPod in and I'm just, you know, listening to Jay-Z and Kanye, there's a Kanye line on Watch the Throne album where he talks about, or he compares the number of deaths in recent U.S. wars with the number of deaths that are occurring on a day-to-day basis in the city of Chicago. And then when I think about Obama, in his initial press conference regarding the Connecticut shootings, I'm thinking about him making a link. You know, if you look at the clip, he's making a link between Connecticut, Aurora, Colorado, the shootings in Oregon, and the city of Chicago. The fact that our president is thinking locally and nationally with respect to how we're thinking about violence is more than simply saying, well, all of these folks in popular culture love him and he would be a great figure to understand. But we also have to consider those daily links that are being established between the things that make us feel good and the things that help us move throughout the day and throughout our weeks and months, but also those national policies that greatly affect us.
We have just about a minute left. I'd like to have you comment on this, Nick Yanis, because in the final part of this collection of essays that you and Darius edited, write a closing comment here to, and I believe the title of the chapter is, What Happened to Obama Mania? Mm-hmm. What is the answer you give?
I basically, going back to our earlier state of how Obama claimed that there's a time to govern or a time to campaign, I think that was one of the things that led to the disenfranchisement, the dissatisfaction within his base, is that he's an incredibly personal person. You go to his anytime he's around, and it's almost like a rock concert. People just start chanting his name. And yet, for some reason, that connection he developed during the election, he just didn't continue it through his first term. So when you go policy by policy of the Affordable Care Act, people support it. But yet he didn't seem to sort of campaign for it after it got passed and talked about all the good things that came of it. And so that sort of that victory sort of got became turned into a defeat and was used against them later on.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, we really only have a couple seconds left. The biggest questions the two of you have in your minds when it comes to pop culture and the relationship to President Obama's second term, what will you be looking for?
Oh, man, I would be looking for more links between, like, the national mindset on race and how that is being talked about in popular culture, but also how people are responding to Obama via popular culture.
Nick, quickly.
I'm curious to see how Obama's going to be represented in more newer media, such as in digital platforms such as video games. They have a huge window to get – it takes a long time to develop a video game, so I'm curious to see how they're going to integrate him more into that platform.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us. A fascinating book. Nick Yanis and Darius Carter, two doctoral students at the University of Iowa. The Iconic Obama, the title of a book that they've just edited, a collection of essays, media representations of President Obama. Thank you, too, for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Always a pleasure to have you come into our studio. Thank you, Donna.
It's great to be here, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support in Cedar Falls from Tony Daner. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River, a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.